I want to welcome you all back to a special episode of the Freedom Train podcast series. As you know, I am Joseph Ward, and usually my co-host Patrick Irvin would be here. He couldn't make it today, so I want to give a shout out to Patrick Irvin. But welcome back all of our listeners, all of our viewers, everybody who has been supporting the Freedom Train podcast series since its inception till now. Thank you, thank you, thank you. You have been a part of this growth. Also, remember that the Freedom Train podcast series is brought to you by PAX Inc. That's P-A-C-T-S-I-N-C. And PAX Inc. is an organization that is founded around giving back to the Black community. It's a think tank organization, but the website, www.pactsinc.org, has a plethora of resources for the Black community as far as audio information, video information, survival information, Black history information, just all type of information that you can enjoy and you can share with your family and friends. And make sure you take advantage of the Amazon Smile program. Amazon Smile program is a program where when you go to amazonsmile.com and you sign up, you're able to pick a nonprofit organization that you want to support. So every time you make a purchase, a portion of your proceeds will go to that organization, so you can make PAX Inc. that organization. So remember, go to amazonsmile.com and you can register under PAX Inc., P-A-C-T-S-I-N-C.org. And make sure while you're online, you visit our Freedom Train website at www.freedomtrainradio.com. That way you can learn more about the Freedom Train Network, all of our podcasters, and all of the initiatives and events that we have coming up. So this is a special interview. It's a returning interview. I am proud and I'm privileged and I'm honored for our esteemed guest today. In 2016, there was a push to posthumously exonerate the Honorable Marcus Messiah Garvey. And this was the last year of President Obama's presidency. So we were proud to be a part of the push. We had a chance to interview our guest. And Patrick and I, we used as much of our resources, as much as the social currency that we have, to be a part of the push to help get the posthumous exoneration. It didn't subsequently happen, but we are here again in 2021 under the Biden administration to work again to get a posthumous exoneration of the Honorable Marcus Messiah Garvey. And our esteemed guest is his son, Dr. Julius Garvey. So welcome to the Freedom Train podcast series, Dr. Garvey.
Thank you so much for having me, Joseph. And, you know, reminding everybody that we were doing this back in 2016 with this the second term towards the end of Obama's second term. And it didn't happen at that time with our first Black president. We yeah. were at that time, you know, very, very positive that it would happen, you know, having a Black president and thinking that he understood the shoulders on which he stood. Certainly yes. one of them was Marcus Garvey
yes.
back in the 20s and 30s, standing up for our rights as human beings and our civil rights. But that didn't happen. And I appreciate your help at that time and appreciate the fact that you're having me here now on your Freedom Train broadcast. And as we are attempting to bring, you know, the same situation, shall we say, the injustice done to Marcus Garvey, we're attempting to bring that now to the Biden administration. So yes. I'm happy to be here and thank you for having me and not giving up on the process that we need to continue doing in yes, order sir. To get this exoneration. Now, as well, you mentioned, it has to be called a posthumous pardon because that's within the power of the president. But obviously yes. it would have to state that Marcus Garvey was innocent of the charges for it yes. to be a true exoneration. That's what we want.
Yes, yes. And that's some information within the interview that I do want to make sure that we cover and reiterate so people can really understand the full story. I know we've had the conversation. I've made sure I've done extensive reading on it. So I do want people to know about that. But before we get to that portion, I would like to like our viewers to learn more about yourself. So could you tell our viewers a bit about yourself, yourself professionally, and once again, why this posthumous exoneration is important for you and why you are once again spearheading this effort?
I'm the second son of Marcus Garvey. My older brother, Marcus Garvey Jr., just passed away last year in December. So I'm, in a sense, the surviving offspring of Marcus and Amy Jakes Garvey. My career has been as a cardiothoracic and vascular surgeon, and I basically retired from this now in the last 2 years now, mm-hmm. in terms of retirement. I guess I was fortunate in timing it just before the COVID crisis. I didn't have to go through that as a physician trying to take care of patients
right.
during a pandemic. I mean, that's horrendous in and of itself. So that's who I am in a nutshell. I'm my father's son, in that I was brought up as a Pan-Africanist. I understand his thinking, I understand his ideology. He died when I was very young, but my mother taught me a lot about him. And of course, subsequently, I've read, you know, everything in a sense that he has written. Yes. And I carry the DNA, so I feel very much like my father's son. And I understand what he was trying to do at that time, which is more than 100 years ago. And I understand that circumstances haven't changed that much. So yes. to carry on his legacy is of extreme importance in terms of fighting, you know, racism, fighting white supremacy, fighting a system that, you know, enslaved us, that has colonized us, and that continues to oppress us. I mean, you know, we see it in the police brutality, and we see it in terms of the system itself, and that we have had no reparations for, you know, our enslavement of over 250 years. And, the subsequent 150 years has been systematic in terms of Jim Crow and in terms of oppression, whether it's from the Ku Klux Klan or so-called legitimate government, which over and over again has denied us, you know, access to right. what other Americans get in terms of support. And with this, in terms of the bank, it's banking, it's terms of healthcare, it's terms of access to jobs, and so on. So that, you know, over this period of time, we have been worse than second class citizens. We have been right. like no citizens, so to speak. And we've been treated as we see how the Haitians have been treated at the border recently. I mean, mm-hmm. that's what has happened to us internally. You know, and we can see it in terms of our mortality rate. We can see what has happened in the pandemic because of the pre-existing negative health situations that most of us have. We certainly die sooner than our counterparts. We have more illness, more suicide, more murders, more violence,
yes.
more incarcerations. I mean, we're terribly disadvantaged, and it hasn't really changed all that much. Some of us right. have gotten through, and we have a little bigger middle class, and we have some people who are in different positions, whether it's in terms of large companies or it's in terms of the government. And now we have a black female vice president, if you will, and we've had a black president. But, you know, despite those things, we have not really moved forward in terms
right.
of the average black person. That's what I'm saying now, in terms of 80 or 90% of us, we have not really, if you will, escaped the ghetto in which we have been placed. And I don't mean that so much physically in
right.
terms of where we live, but in terms of the whole situation of in the inability for us to really express ourselves to be the best that we can be, whether it's educationally or in terms of entrepreneurship and support that we should be getting from our society, where we pay taxes, and from our country where we live, where we have gone to war, we have defended the country. But again, we are not treated appropriately. We're still disadvantaged. And so the fight continues. And certainly, you know, many of us have been criminalized. My father has been criminalized, you know, more than 100 years ago,
mm-hmm.
With false charges, with no evidence. The same thing, was being tried with Martin Luther King. J. Edgar Hoover was trying the same thing, to criminalize him. And we see what happened to the Black Panthers. They were criminalized
right.
and destroyed. So all of our movements to elevate ourselves, the leaders have been done away with in one way or another. We know that, you know, Malcolm X's death was right. something that was organized. We don't know exactly who all the organizers were, but we know it's part of a system where anyone who stands up for the Black community, anyone who is a genuine leader becomes marginalized, criminalized, or destroyed. So that's why I'm on this effort, shall we say, you know, to exonerate my father, because I think we need to decriminalize who we are. We need to legitimize
yes.
who we are in terms of our thinking. You know, we are the oldest people on the planet in terms of Homo sapiens sapiens. We are the first civilizations on the planet. If we look at our philosophy, our ontology, our cosmology, it's the best in terms of, you know, our optimal way of looking at things, optimal psychology, if you will, because we believe that we're spiritual people having a physical existence.
Yes,
we don't
sir.
Think that we're just our physical beings, and we are not involved totally in quote scientific materialism as the be all and end all of our existence as human beings. So I think we have a deeper understanding of our humanity, which we have always had in terms of the mm-hmm. African continent, and this needs to come to the fore. And that's what we need in terms of African people. But I think the whole world needs that at this point, what I call African humanism. And it's been existent in Africa for thousands of years. And a lot of people have learned from us, whether the Indians or the Chinese or those in the Middle East, they've all learned from us. Greece learned from us, Rome learned from us, etc. So, you know, we need to understand our history, and we need to be able to learn our yes. history. In the public school system, it needs to be taught properly. Civilization didn't start with the Greeks. It started with us, when the Greeks actually were savages, and the Greeks learned from us. The Romans learned from us. The English learned from us, and so on and so forth. So those are the things that we're fighting for, I mean, continuously, you know, from my father's time until now. And you know, my father's exoneration is one thing, like I said. We need to have reparations as another thing. And it's not just a one shot. I mean, we need to have a transformation
yes.
in the society so that as African people, we can be respected, for ourselves as people, not as someone who's trying to imitate what Europeans have accomplished. That's not who we are. We have a longer history, and we have a deeper understanding, I would say, of civilization, which I think is needed by everybody at the present time.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. And I totally agree within the circles that I exist in. And on this podcast, we often talk about our need as a people to self-actualize, our need as a people to make sure that we put ourselves in the best position for us to win for ourselves, because we've never had that chance to do that in America. I get upset when I think about the idea of we're expected to be at the forefront of the liberation of other groups of people without first putting ourselves in the best position to be the greatest allies as possible, but yet no other people are expected to be the best allies to us. Mm-hmm. And so that's why we should be working together. Us coming together to help each other shouldn't be a second thought. It should be just our nature. And so we getting back to that. Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. So, and we talked about this briefly, but 2016, Barack Obama is president. He's in his second term. He's in the last year of his second term. You're pushing to get the exoneration of your father. Why do you believe the Obama administration did not grant the exoneration of your father?
It's hard for me to say, and anything I say is obviously speculation.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I think that overall, presidents are, you might say, prisoners of their office,
okay.
If you look back at, for example, Kennedy, he was assassinated by whatever the power structure was, in terms of him doing something that certain powerful groups didn't want him to do. And I don't have to name names, because I mm-hmm. can't really name names in terms of identity. but I think that was obvious. Clearly, he was assassinated. And it wasn't really a lone person who was a lunatic. It obviously right. had to have been something that was really worked out in advance. And who those people are, I don't know. And clearly, I couldn't name names. But this is the situation. I mean, if you look, for example, at Eisenhower towards the end of his term, you know, he said, look, I've been in this thing and so on and so forth. But guys, watch out for the military-industrial complex. They're the ones that are running the country. So, right. you know, he couldn't have done anything while he was in office. But at least he gave us some kind of warning in terms of what was going on. So whether it's the military-industrial complex or whatever, you know, the system is run by very powerful people who are very rich people, large corporate interests that run not only the United States, but run the world. So any president is beholden to them. America is the most powerful country in the world, has been for a long time. So the president, while he sits on that seat of the most powerful country in the world, he may not be the most powerful person right. in the world, in that he can't just call the shots. He has to check with somebody and maybe several people and say, well, look, is this okay or is that not okay? Or people will tell him, do this and do that. And that's the reality of the politics of the situation. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure I'm not telling anybody news. In some sense, I mean, I'm not just saying, you know, oh, Obama was a bad guy. I mean, that's not right. the point. That's not the point. He was unable to do this. Whether he would have wished to do it on his own or not, I don't know. There's no way I could know that. But I know that it was presented to him formally, legally, with all the legal background and in the right manner. Mm-hmm. And then it was not accomplished. So,
okay.
Everybody can draw their own conclusion, so to speak, without right. necessarily attributing blame, you know, to one person or not.
Right. Now, thank you for that clarity, because I know a lot of people, their thoughts are, well, he didn't do this because of this or that. And, you know, people form their own opinions, their own narratives. But we know that especially a black president, the first black president, was not going to be able to do a lot of things that he may have wanted to do within this administration. But that doesn't mean that we still don't push and apply the pressure to get these things done, especially for somebody like the Honorable Marcus Messiah Garvey, who gave so much to African people around the globe. So that's why we are here again, to make sure the push is continued. And so Justice for Garvey is the official name of the initiative. It's the official name of the effort. Could you give our listeners, because I've been able to read through the website, so could you give our listeners a description of the Justice for Garvey effort and ways that they can support it?
Well, basically, it's, as you say, it's trying to achieve, you know, justice for Garvey. And the effort itself, in terms of the label, is Justice, the number 4, Garvey. And the website is justice4garvey.org. And, you know, the Twitter account, you can go on Twitter and go to Justice, the number 4, you know, Garvey, and you can communicate with the president that way, in terms of asking him for a posthumous pardon for Marcus Garvey, and to clear Marcus Garvey's name. There's also another effort on change.org. To clear Marcus Garvey's name. So there are sort of several efforts out there, several ways in which you can involve yourself. Obviously, another way is through the Congress, so to speak, in that Congresswoman Clark from New York has put before the Congress House Resolution 148, and I think she did this in February, which is to exonerate Marcus Garvey. So this is a bill before the House and the Congress, and it is I think before the Justice Judiciary Committee at the present time, so it needs congressional support. So any body with contact with their congressperson or not, you know, any sort of influential person, or simply just writing to their congressperson and asking them to support this bill would also be very, very helpful, because that would tend to move it through Congress. And of course, the president would have to listen to that.
Right.
So any influential person who knows someone close to the Biden administration can also pick up the phone and call, because again, it's a glaring injustice that has festered for over 100 years. And, you know, Marcus Garvey, has been recognized as not only a civil rights champion in the United States, but a human rights champion around the world. He's Jamaica's first national hero. He's a first, he's a hero of the Organization of American States, which they made him a hero in 2009. And this is about 33, American states, of which the United States and Canada are also part of it. So here he is, America participates in making him a hero of the Americas, and yet he's a criminal inside the country. And of course, he's honored all over Africa with street names and with statues and so on. So, he is a hero to millions of people, as he was, back in the 20s. He had more than 6 million, followers. Mm-hmm. And he has millions of people who have followed him over time and consider him a hero of great significance. The greatest Pan-Africanist of the first half of the 20th century, who influenced not only the civil rights movement, but the Pan-African movement and the liberation of Africa and the Caribbean, meaning, people such as Kwame Nkrumah and Jomo Kenyatta, Nnamdi Azikiwe, and on and on. I mean, I've spoken to Nelson Mandela's grandson, and he tells me how much, Nelson Mandela was influenced by my father's thought and so on. Same thing with Steve Biko. I was speaking to his son, etc., telling me the same thing. So here's Marcus Garvey, who led freedom movements all over. Every independent country in the Caribbean, their leaders were Garveyites or influenced by Garvey at some point in time. So around the world, he has been involved in the freedom movements, anti-colonial struggles that have led to the freedom. Now we have 54 countries in Africa that are free and independent. We have all the Caribbean countries that are free and independent. And the civil rights movement here in the United States that is gathering steam again, I think, with the Black Lives movement, Black Lives Matter cry that is out there, not just in the streets, but I think everybody now sees that we haven't made as much progress as we need to make, certainly since the time of Martin Luther King and his sacrifice. He sacrificed his life, for us, as did Marcus Garvey, as did Malcolm X, as did the Panthers. So there's, blood in the streets, and people have died for our freedom. So we have to pick up the baton, so to speak, and carry it forward. And we have to put pressure on the administration. We have to put pressure on our politicians that represent us, for them to do the things that we think would move our communities forward. I mean, we can't continue, to have so many of our young men and women to ending up in jail. I mean, 40% of the prison population is African-American, when we represent 12 to 15% of the population. So we're being criminalized. And certainly, with the unemployment and lack of educational opportunity, et cetera, we turn against each other, and we create black and black violence, which, the suicide rate and the homicide rate is very, very high within the black community. These things have to be corrected, and we need the tools to be able to correct these things.
Exactly.
And that's what we have to repair. And reparations is not just about money. It's repairing who we are, our identity, and what we can accomplish and what we need to accomplish in terms of being all that we can be That's what needs to be appeared when we speak about reparations. So it's a movement, and it's a movement that will continue, and obviously it's going to grow over time, because you know every generation picks it up. You know, it was in the 20s and 30s with my dad. It was in the 60s with Malcolm X and Martin Luther King. You know, then in the 90s, and then here we are again, 2020. So 2021. So this now just generation has picked it up, and Black Lives Matter.
Yes.
And the young people are involved, and they will be heard, you know, and we have to help them to understand that it's not just this generation, but it's been going on for a long time. It's been going on from the Civil War. It's been going on, you know, when there was no reconstruction, when we didn't get 40 acres, and when, you know, there's a farm bill out there to help Black farmers, and it's not going through the Congress or the Judiciary Department. We need to push our president and our Congress people, you know, to help the Black farmers so that they can survive and produce and so on. So, you know, there are a lot of issues, and, you know, the injustice against our people, and Marcus Garvey is certainly one glaring one.
Exactly. Yeah. Reading about everything that happened with your father, and going back and reiterating the interview that we did years ago. And if I remember correctly, you were talking about him being convicted, but they used, of course, lies, but a blank envelope to try to say this is one of the things that he was trying to use to sell the stock for the Black Star Line, and false witnesses, no real evidence, but yet the conviction still happened, especially the push by the FBI, wasn't the FBI at that time, but the push by the government, especially J. Edgar Hoover, to eliminate the Black Messiah. Mm-hmm. And so my generation, we haven't been taught greatly about Marcus Garvey, but we have been influenced by him, because a lot of us may not fully understand the power and the message behind the red, black, and green, but we understand that there is substance there. We understand that this is something that we need to align ourselves with. And in learning more about it, and once again, thank you for being here to be able to help us get a greater understanding of it. It gives us more power and just more energy to continue to push and to let you know that my generation is behind all the efforts of the previous generations, and we're going to make sure the generations behind us have that steam as well.
Yeah, well, you know, it's important that, you know, it goes from one generation to the next. And of course, that's one of the problems that we have, is that we don't have our own educational system, you know, and clearly then, you know, formats like what you have, Joseph, is important for us to be able to communicate with our young people. Because, you know, they don't get this in school. As you know, there's this big fight now about how you critical race theory and how you
do right.
American history. So it may get even worse in terms of the propaganda and the lies that
yes.
are being taught as truth, because people don't want to face the truth, because the truth is so ugly that has taken place over the last
right.
You know, 400 years. So, again, this is of extreme importance. And, you know, I mean, if you look back to the period in terms of young people, you know, that they have to realize that, you know, over and over again, we as Black people, we as African Americans, try to lift ourselves up. And over again, we have been pushed down. And not just pushed down in terms of gently being pushed out of the way, but destroyed. And,
yes.
And you know, some of the young people may know about Tulsa and Black Wall Street, which was 1921. And this is the same time as my father. My father,
right.
you know, created the UNIA in 1914. But he came to America in 1916 and ended up staying here and creating the UNIA in the United States in 1917. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you can go back even before, you know, Tulsa, which was 1921, as I recall, and then the invasion and destruction of what was called Black Wall Street, where we had our independent community.
Mm-hmm.
You see, and this is one of the people that people say, one of the things people say, gee, you know, we want to be separate. It's not about being separate. We want to be independent.
Right.
You know, we want our own independent banks. You know, we want to live in independent communities where we can take care of ourselves, where, you know, whether you're a carpenter or a mason or you have a restaurant or a theater or whatever it is, but it's ours, you know, in terms of our community, in terms of the church or whatever it is, the religious situation. So we want that independence. We don't want that to be dependent on anybody. So whenever we have done that, I just mentioned, you know, Tulsa. But if you go back to 1919, that was called the Red Summer. Yes. When there were umpteen, you know, riots, and not just riots, there were invasions of the Black community all over, you know, and the reason why it was called the Red Summer was that so much blood was shed, whether it was in Chicago or Philadelphia or wherever, Florida, you know, all over, you see. And this was happening when our young fellows came back from the war, 1914-18 war. They were being lynched in their uniforms and saying that they were not taking jobs away from quotes white people when they fought for democracy overseas. So here we are fighting for democracy, giving our lives for America and for democracy. Coming home, we're being assassinated, lynched by the Ku Klux Klan. We form our own communities. We got no reparations. We form our own communities, developing our own communities. And white racists invade our communities, burn it down and kill us. And this happens repeatedly over and over and over. And then they point the finger and say, gee, you know, why don't you people lift yourself up by your own bootstraps? Well, you took away the bootstraps. You took away the boots, and we're barefoot.
Right.
But you have been doing this repeatedly. Every time we buy a pair of boots, you take them away.
Right.
And it's the same thing with Marcus Garvey. I mean, he came with an economic program. His program in Harlem, the Negro Factories Corporation, and African Communities League, the UNIA, they had so many businesses. First of all, the newspaper, the printing press, they did a lot of the printing there. They had a doll factory, they had a millinery, and they made uniforms, they made dresses. Mm-hmm. They had a moving company, they had restaurants, laundromats, and so on. They employed more than 1,000 people in Harlem.
Wow.
In New York, you know, working out of that UNIA. And not just the headquarters, but all of the businesses that they had, you know. So it was a thriving economic organization. And, of course, the Black Muslims took a page out of that picture. But then he went on to the Black Star Line and so on, because that was the way now for us to communicate in terms of African-Americans with those of us in the Caribbean and those of us still on the motherland. And when they saw that, you know, they said, oh, my goodness, this Negro is getting too big.
Right.
When he had that meeting there in New York in 1920, and he filled Madison Square Gardens with more than 25,000 people, I mean, they got scared. But they deliberated there, where they had the parades in Harlem, in August of that year. They deliberated for a month with delegates, more than 2,000 delegates from all over the world, talking about the problems of our people. Mm-hmm. You see, and Marcus Garvey, you know, gave us that concept of ourselves in terms of our identity of African people, ourselves as a nation. You know, again, the Nation of Islam came out of that, you know, because this was a nation of African people all over the world. And that's what they deliberated about in 1920, and came up with the rights of the Negro peoples of the world, which were 54 statements of, you know, who we are and how we needed to be treated and what we expected and demanded. And that was our, you know, our charter, our Magna Carta, if you will. And we had that before the United Nations had any sort of human rights declaration in 1948. We had that in 1920. And of course, that's where the red, black, and green came, as you mentioned. That was given to us in convention by these 2,000 delegates who said, you know, red was for the blood of our forefathers that had been shed, you know, in terms of our freedom. And black was for who we are as a people. And green was for the wealth and productivity of the continent of Africa. So that's where we got the red, black, and green. And we got a holiday, August the 31st, you know, and we got when we had an anthem, because a lot of, way back in those days, people would say, the coon doesn't have a flag, the coon doesn't have a country. You see, because that was the thing, you know, Africa was a civilized place and so on and so forth. Marcus Garvey gave us an identity as, mm-hmm. as not just as human beings, but as people belonging to a nation. And that's why we cherish the red, black, and green so much.
Right.
And you see it in so many, the flags of so many African countries, the red, black, and green, or the black star, for example, in the Ghana flag,
right.
and so on. So, right. you know, that was what was happening in the 20s with Marcus Garvey. And J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI said, there's an internal memo that says there's an agitator up there in Harlem. We've got to get him. And they tried everything. They tried to assassinate him. There was an assassination mm-hmm. in 1919. Somebody came into the Liberty Hall, the office in Harlem, and shot at him. I think about four or five times, and then two or three of them grazed him, one his head and one his leg, but didn't do any significant damage. Mm-hmm. They arrested the person in the office. The police came. They took him to jail. But funnily enough, he committed suicide in the jail within 24 hours. You know, so he was
the usual.
Supposedly committed suicide.
I mean, right.
Of course, the word on the street is that he was getting ready to spill the beans as to who sent him. You know, so that didn't work. And they tried to get my dad on a Mann Act, which is moving somebody across state lines for moral purposes. So they hired the first black FBI agents, you know. To infiltrate the Garvey organization. That's what that whole COINTELPRO thing started. And that's how the first black agents of the FBI came about, to infiltrate the Garvey organization. And they were supposed to go, you know, he would travel a lot and so on. And my mother was the secretary. And of course, they'd be looking through the keyholes and through the transom to see if he was engaged in moral activities, but they couldn't find anything. But
right.
I know they tried this against Martin Luther King later on, too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know,
and wanted him to supposedly commit suicide over there. We did the same thing. They had all these tapes and so on. So this was a technique that they had. And, you know, if you can't get rid of them one way, you know. But they knew that my dad was an immigrant, and that's one of the things. We've got to get him on some charge, and then we can get him out of the country. Of course, they tried to prevent him coming into the country and prevent him from applying, getting his citizenship papers and so on. So, you know, this was very, very conspiratorial on the part of J. Edgar Hoover, on the part of the FBI and other organizations, where, you know, Marcus Garvey was appealing to the hearts and minds of the average, you know, African-American. And the organization was growing by leaps and bounds, and it was doing very good things economically and otherwise.
Yes. Yeah. And that's apparent, because what you just explained are patterns of behavior that I've seen by the government from somebody that they would describe as a black messiah, or a black person that has too much power, or how they would say, an uppity Negro, who too many black people. Hold on. Black people are actually thinking for themselves and following a black person who's telling them to be the best that they can be, rather than following the cues of things. Now, and I see now, in my opinion, I believe that they've kind of learned a bit from that. And so some of the tactics that they use today with the social media, or even neutralizing somebody before they even get too big. But that's why independent channels like these are important, but also stories that you're telling, but you're also letting us know, study for yourselves. Mm-hmm. So we have to study ourselves. We can't wait. We can't continue to wait for somebody to teach us about ourselves. We get the battle with the critical race theory, but it starts at home. If you teach your child at home, you don't have to worry about what they're not teaching in school. And that's for us, you know, we preach that on this channel all the time, but that's where it is with us. It's taking control of our own destiny. Nobody, we're giving our power away when we don't do that.
You're 100% right. I mean, you know, and that's what, you know, Marcus Garvey taught us. I mean, you know, one of my favorite quotes from him is that a people without the knowledge of their past history and origins and culture is like a tree without roots. Right. And that's what we've been, you know, tree without roots, because they took away all of that from us, everything, including our name, and hid our history from us and distorted it. They told us we came from nowhere and that we're nobody. We were even subhuman. Of course, that was how they treated us. They brutalized us. And we, in some sense, even got accustomed to that over time. So we internalized a lot of that negativity. Mm-hmm. You see, but once you learn for yourself, you know, who you are in terms of where you've come from, then you have a better appreciation of who you are and then where you can go in terms of, well, you're not just how somebody else defines you.
Right.
You can define yourself, you know. And another one of my father's quotes that I like is, God and nature, you know, first made us who we are. Then out of our own creative genius, we make ourselves what we want to be. So that was giving us our sense of identity and our sense of, you know, self-reliance. And this was what was manifesting, you know, that whole Harlem Renaissance. This was that whole idea of Black consciousness and who we are as a people. And this was motivated, you know, many, many, you know, Black individuals, Black organizations, and Black freedom movements, as I mentioned, in the Caribbean and Africa. And it continues, you know, and this is our only hope, you know, for the next generation, the next generation, the next generation, is to have that identity as you know, of our somebodyness. You know, we are somebody. We need to know that, but we need to know that concretely. We need to know who the Egyptians were. You know, first civilization was us. Nubia was us. Mero was us. Kush was us. Ethiopia was us. You know, and Carthage was us. As you go down the line, and you know, all of those civilizations coming through time, they were us. I mean, you know, again, you know, before the so-called vaunted European civilizations didn't start there. All of those people, you know, the Greeks, the Romans, etc., they went to Africa to learn. You know, they came back and helped to develop their own civilizations. And teachers from Africa came to, you know, both Greece and Rome to teach them about civilization. So this is a reality. But of course, you know, the system based on white supremacy doesn't want to acknowledge that and doesn't want us to learn about that.
Because
you know, you have to liberate your minds from mental slavery. And once you do that, then you're a whole new person. You're not taking orders from anybody else. You're not looking to anybody else to tell you who you are in terms of your identity. And you don't need to sit next to anybody in a classroom in order to learn. You can sit in your own school, in your own neighborhood, with your own books and learn, you know.
Exactly.
So that's the independence, I think, that my father taught and that we need continuously for our young people to develop to be the best that they can be.
Yes, yes. And that our young people can be the best that they can be. And I truly wholeheartedly believe that we will get to a point where we self-actualize and be in full control of our destiny. So a question that I do have, am I reading? I came across some information, but I would like clarity. And you kind of spoke to it earlier. The FBI and a lot of enemies of Marcus Garvey, they couldn't get any bad information on him, his character, or find him doing anything that he shouldn't be doing. But they did try to speak ill of him or say that he wasn't the greatest leader, or attacking his leadership skills, or attacking his relationships, or even some failed relationships with certain people. So could you kind of clear up some people's misconceptions about the way Marcus Garvey carried himself and how he treated people, and his overall character?
Well, his character was excellent. He's what I call, a lot of people call, a servant leadership, a servant leader. I mean, he signed everything, Marcus Garvey, you know, your humble servant. even right. though he was head of an organization, and he was voted to be, you know, president general of Africa in that sense, that the UNIA was a nation in exile. And, you know, there were a lot of people with, shall we say, different ideas. And if you look at that period of time, it was, you know, just after the revolution in Russia, which was 1917. We talked about the First World War, but the Russian Revolution, which brought the communists to power, was 1917. So communism then became a big thing. And many Negro leaders, if you will, was looking to communism, or aka socialism, as a means, you know, for development of Black people, feeling mm-hmm. that the socialists, communists would be better than the capitalists. Right. My father didn't agree with that because, you know, there was still what he considered to be white supremacists. Not only that, but, you know, he didn't agree with the ideology either. So there were those people on the left, if you will. And then on the right, there were the sort of integrationists, assimilationists, who wanted to join the system, you know, and were hoping that somehow, you know, the system would treat them better over time. Mm-hmm. Plus the fact that they really didn't understand their own history, because, you know, Carter G. Woodson, you know, said in The Miseducation of the Negro, many of these people had PhDs or what have you, and were considered to be intellectuals. But, you know, when you teach the Negro or the African-American, whatever they were called at that time, Negroes or Black, mm-hmm. when you teach the Negro the same history, the same philosophy, the same religion, and the same morality as those who have enslaved you practice, then you're teaching him really to hate himself.
Right.
And he said, he went further. That is, he said, you know, not only are you teaching him to quotes, you know, be like you and to hate himself, but it says, you know, you're teaching him to go to the back door. As a matter of fact, if he doesn't find a back door, he will go there and make the back door yes. himself, because education makes that imperative. Mm-hmm. And this is the point. If you learn the same things as quotes, you know, the white man in that sense, the European American, and they tell you all about their triumphalism and exceptionalism, then what about the Native American? You know, this was their land. You know, how did you, quotes, triumph from sea to shining sea? I mean, right. There was an awful lot of murder and, you know, smallpox and the trail of tears and on and on and on that you're hiding and you're putting under the rug and so on and so forth. You know, I remember growing up with those cowboy movies where the Indian was the bad guy.
Always.
The settler was the good guy. And you couldn't understand why this Indian wouldn't allow this white man to take all the land. Because somehow, in the cowboy movies, it was supposed to be the white man's land, so to speak. Mm-hmm. It was the same thing. I grew up with the Tarzan movies. You know, where Tarzan was this white guy in the jungle, and the black people wanted to put white people into a big pot and boil them and eat them. And Tarzan was swinging through this jungle, and he was king of the jungle. Now, how the hell does he get over there and be king of the jungle? What's wrong with all these black people there?
Right.
You know, but this is the propaganda that destroys mm-hmm. the mind, you know, over time. You know, like Benny Goodman is the king of swing, you know, and Elvis Presley is right. the king of something else again. Well, who are these people? Where did swing come from? Where did rock and roll come from?
Exactly.
Come on, baby, you know. So, you know, this is all the lies and the propaganda that are told to us, you know, year after year after year, you know, over the last, you know, 500 years. And history has been rewritten from the 17th and 18th century. So the books have been burned and history was rewritten. And we're getting this nonsense as gospel truth. And it continues to be distorted over time. So we need our own educational, you know, system. We need to be able to teach ourselves. We have said this, we need to be able to pass this sort of information on to our youngsters. And if we don't get it in the school system, we certainly have to learn it for ourselves and teach it to our kids at home. But yes, we have to keep pushing for a transformation of the society, transformation of the educational system, transformation of the healthcare system, transformation of the financial system. There has to be a serious transformation here in the United States of America and around the world. I was just listening to a speech by the president of Ghana at the United Nations, you know, talking about the IMF and the World Bank and how they need to change because they're not representing the African people at all. And, you know, you have 54 countries. You have 1.5 billion people in Africa. Mm-hmm. And they're not represented, appropriately, proportionately in terms of the IMF and the World Bank. And so all of these systems are set up to keep us down and to take our resources and to prevent us from really growing and being able to develop appropriately so that we can take care of ourselves and be prosperous and take care of our children and the next generation. So these things need to be changed. Yes.
Yes. Yes. They definitely need to be changed. But that's why, once again, efforts such as the Justice for Garvey effort is a step in the right direction. Of course, it's not the full change, but it's a step in the right direction because we're righting a great wrong, but we're also it's a building of momentum, but it's also a building of a specific mindset for a group of people to understand that if this can happen to such a great leader as the Honorable Marcus Garvey, think about what's happening to the everyday Black person who no one knows about. So we need to be able to protect ourselves on all costs, because as you spoke earlier about us being able to build our own towns, build these economic centers, but we weren't able to protect them the way we needed to. So being able to build and protect, I always say, if we build it, we must protect it. Mm-hmm. So I want to ask you about Garveyism and like exactly what is Garveyism and what is a Garvey Act? Because we hear it all the time. My generation, we hear it. Nobody has ever really explained it. It's told to us like we're just supposed to know. So could you help us understand exactly Garveyism and what a Garveyite is?
Well, basically Garveyism is the philosophy of Marcus Garvey. And of course, there are three volumes of his philosophy and opinions. Many people don't know that. They don't know what the third volume, but there are three volumes. And of course, there's a lot more in terms of, there are 13 volumes that were accumulated of the Negro World, which was his weekly newspaper, which was the most popular weekly in the United States and of course across the world, Black Weekly, from about 1918 to the 1930s. So there's a lot of information about there in terms of, you know, basically what he said and his philosophy. And it stretches, you know, across many, many areas. We talked a little bit, just mentioning his psychology in terms of liberating your minds from mental slavery. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's based on an African history. We talk about that you must know, your history per se. It deals with an economic system that we must own, you know, our own businesses and the way in which the businesses were set up in terms of the African Communities League. There were cooperative enterprises which weren't simply a matter of shareholder profit, but had to do with the stakeholders, meaning those who had a stake in the business itself. And this is not just the people, quotes, who invested, but the people who worked there and the people who were being supplied with the commodities. So that the business then had a social purpose. It wasn't just for making money, but it had a positive social spin-off. So it was both sustainable and then having a developmental, sustainable gotcha. Developmental our purpose. So he was ahead of his time mm-hmm. in terms of being a social entrepreneur.
Right.
If you look at that, he had his own concept about, government. If you look at the Westminster type of government, it's a two-party system or a multi-party system when everybody has an opinion and you see nothing can go through the Congress because if it goes through the House, it gets stalled in the Senate. And there's reasons why it gets stalled. There are political reasons and so on and so forth. So the productivity of your politicians is really, a negative. I mean, people mm-hmm. go through a whole term and nothing gets through the Congress. Either party doesn't want it to get through, you have to appeal to the other party.
Right.
And when the other party gets in power, they change everything that you did. I mean, it's really a nonsensical system. It's like, kind of civilized political war, where one party is warring against the other party. Well, that's not what politics should be about. But right. then you have to read his solution in terms of that. But then if you go to things like religion, he said that, God obviously is a spirit. But, most of us, when we need to talk or think about God, we do it in an anthropomorphic way, meaning that we think of God as a person. Mm-hmm. So if we're going to do that, then we need to think of God as a black person, not as a white
yes.
person. Because if your God is white, then obviously you're going to worship white people. Mm-hmm. God is black, then you're going to worship black people. And the same thing, was in terms of Jesus. He traced his genealogy back to show that he was a brown man. And mm-hmm. if you look at just the situation where he came out of the Middle East, historically, if it's truly a historical figure, then he would have had to be a brown person, not an Anglo-Saxon
exactly.
or a blonde, blue-eyed person. And we know how that picture came, in terms of Michelangelo painting his cousin or his uncle or whatever,
right.
and giving us that as Jesus. So, he corrected a lot of that sort of nonsensical stuff. He was the first person that made black dolls. And also he was a psychologist
okay.
in terms of understanding, again, that if you have little black children playing with white dolls, then they're going to love white people and white people as opposed to loving black people. If you show them a black doll, they'll say, what's that? When you teach them to love white dolls. So you have to give them black dolls so that they learn to love black
exactly.
people, learn to love themselves. So he was a master psychologist. He was a master organizer in terms of what he was able to create. He was a journalist. He wrote poetry. Mm-hmm. And we can go on and on. But he gave us the basis of everything in terms of religion, in terms of philosophy, in terms of an economic system, in terms of a political system, in terms of organizational structure. The way the UNIA was organized, it was like a nation. It was
yes.
in exile. He had, the nurses, he had a transportation corps, he had a legion, a militaristic a legion, as well as all these different businesses, small and medium-sized business, and then the large enterprises, mm-hmm. which was the Black Star Line and the Liberia Project and so on. So, that's what kind of Garveyism was about, an economic system and a philosophy. That's based on our history as the original people, the original civilization, and a way of looking at ourselves, which is an optimal psychology, so that we see ourselves as beautiful and as original and with all the potential of anybody else in the world. So in kind of a nutshell, that's a little bit of what Garveyism is.
Now that is excellent. That is perfect. And that should be simple for people to understand. I greatly appreciate what you're doing. I greatly appreciate that you were able to pick up the mantle and be able to carry on an initiative like this to be able to exonerate your father. But I'm grateful to be able to be a part of something like this. Like I said, I believe we live in a time where we have a lot of people who they see what your father did and they want to emulate him. And I don't think it's anything wrong with emulating him, but I think we have a lot of people who greatly want to be the next rather than being the greatest versions of themselves. And so trying too hard to be the next, they may overlook the small things that we could do on a daily basis to help make ourselves better rather than looking to make a grand splash upon people. And being able to be a part of something like this is exactly what I'm saying. Not trying to make a grand splash, but understanding that sometimes you have to be the spoke in the wheel. Sometimes you need to be the soldier. You're not going to always be the general. You need to be the soldier. But as long as we reach our goal as a people, then that's all that really matters. Yes, sir. So justiceforgarvey.org is the website. Please go in, visit the website. Now, there's a time period where 100,000 signatures need to be acquired. What is that time period?
Well, you know, there are different ways to look at that. Different people have been doing different petitions, so to speak. Mm-hmm. You know, I can't prevent anyone from putting a petition out there. So mm-hmm. you know, I can't put any limits on people doing this.
Okay.
And that, in some sense, from my perspective, it's immaterial whether the number comes in under the 3 months or not. I think mm-hmm. what is important is to be able to get President Biden's attention. So I think as many people, as often as possible, if you will, over whatever period of time from now until whenever, you know, can go to the Twitter account, Justice the number 4 Garvey, and ask the president for a posthumous pardon. They can also go to whitehouse.gov / president and ask President Biden to use the executive privilege for the posthumous pardon. So that's whitehouse, .gov. And that's mm-hmm. Justice, for Garvey, the Twitter account. Those are two ways that they can go and sign a petition that would get to the president. The most direct way, of course, is whitehouse.gov/president, because that goes directly to him. And again, as I mentioned, your congressperson or anyone else, who you can influence to join, so to speak, in terms of signing these petitions or implementing a petition, I think would be helpful.
Right.
So, yeah.
Yes. So all of my Freedom Train family, all of my On the Shoulders of Giants family, all of my PAX Inc. family, anybody who claimed to be a friend of mine and friend of a friend of a friend of a friend, yeah. All of our people, this is something that we need to get behind. We have to get behind. This is us looking out for us and us. So we talk about how greatly we love our icons, our heroes, our legends. This is a chance for us to give back to a man that gave so much to us. So let's get behind it. Let's get behind it. Let's get the signatures and let's fight. Let's get Joe Biden's attention and let's make them get this exoneration done. Let's do this.
Wonderful.
Yes, sir. So the highly esteemed Dr. Julius Garvey, I greatly appreciate you. If there's even beyond this, if there's any way I myself or my platform can be of any assistance to you, mm-hmm. you have my email, you have my contact information. Please reach out to me. I'm available. I understand, like we talked about earlier, of being of service, mm-hmm. and I am of service to my people. So if there's any way we can help, please look, please let me know and we will do
all right. We'll be in contact with you, because I'll also send you, some of the reasons why Marcus Garvey should be exonerated.
Yes, sir.
In terms of, you mentioned that no evidence except an empty envelope, but there are so many other things. So we will inform you about the judicial misconduct that was carried out in order to get Marcus Garvey out of the way.
Yes,
and
sir.
To show
yes,
you how they can use the judiciary system and corrupt it in order to, prevent, African people from being who they really need to be and they can be.
Yes. Yes, sir. And we'll make sure we use that information to the best of our ability and keep the push going. So I thank you for stopping by my platform and having this sit down. I look forward to having another conversation to sit down with you. Like I say, you're always welcome. And you have a great day.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Joseph. It's been my pleasure.
So once again, the esteemed Dr. Julius Garvey, thank you. I want to thank Dr. Garvey for being here. Justice for Garvey. Look, let's not play around. Pat and I were part of this initiative in 2016. We didn't get the results that we wanted, but Dr. Garvey is back again. And look, let's do this. Let's do this. Let's not play around. Let's do this. Let's get behind this initiative. Justiceforgarvey.org. It's the website, like you said, whitehouse.gov. Justice for Garvey on Twitter. Make sure you get behind it. The links are in the description. The links are in the description under this. Look, let's get behind this. So once again, I am Joseph Ward. This is the Freedom Train podcast series. Shout out to my own The Shoulders of Giants family. Make sure I put this video on that channel as well, because I want my own The Shoulders of Giants family to get this information into here. A lot of the history that Dr. Garvey was speaking, and to be a part of the initiative to get the signatures and to get the exoneration of the Honorable Marcus Mosiah Garvey, who gave so much to us. So let's make sure we give back to our ancestors. With that being said, hey, I love y'all. If anybody told you yet today, I love y'all, love you, and you have a great day. And I see you when I see y'all. Peace out.